The talks are being recorded, so they'll be on the site. Yeah, this is a recording. It's okay, it should go off. It goes off.
Not a heart monitor.
No, not yet. So the talk today, the title is The Shambhala Warrior. Enlightened action in the world. What's it like? What does it feel like to act in the world from the place of Dharma? How is the action? And what does it feel like as an actor to act in the world in this way? I like the concept or the image of the Shambhala warrior. One level, it's a warrior for peace, and a warrior that whose main weapon is wisdom, and this is something, in a way, it's a label that's coming out of the Tibetan tradition, and especially Chogyam Trungpa made it quite a powerful image, but it's something universal. You will see the Shambhala warriors in every corner of the world, and I mentioned one or two yesterday, Palestinian Shambhala warriors, but in this room I'm sure there's Shambhala warriors right here. People who work in the world from wisdom, from love, from understanding, who are fully human beings. It doesn't mean you have to be fully Buddhist, but fully human, yes. That means the potential that we have to act in the world with insight, it's universal, it's available, it's up to us. One of the main characters of the Shambhala warrior is authentic presence. Entirely authentic and fully present. And there's something totally genuine about a person that has authentic presence. Completely genuine. You really feel this person is true to the bottom of their soul, is authentic, authentiude. Its characters would be, characteristics would be humility, energy, courage, and it comes from this authentic presence that we sometimes feel from people who are authentic and who have that power. It comes from meditation. It comes a lot from our practice of being authentically present with our own stuff makes us authentically present in the world. Authentic means no games, no covering, no hypocrisy, no tzviut. We are right there with it. We have no fear about anything that comes because we are right there with the life. Fully authentic. And it can be scary to other people sometimes, actually, because authentic, genuine people sometimes say wrong things and that others don't like and make others sometimes uncomfortable. And you feel that someone who is not authentic is made uncomfortable by someone authentic next to them. By an authentic word or presence can make someone who's not authentic feel uncomfortable and can make them check their own story. So there's a quote from Chogyam Rinpoche, Trungpa Rinpoche, about this. He says, "What is the best approach to helping society. How do you know you are doing good and being authentic? The only answer is nowness. Nowness would be being in the now, being here and now. In meditation, you learn to take an unbiased approach. You let things be as they are without judgment. And that's this quality of nowness, of being with whatever happens, letting it be, letting life be what it is. And it obviously is fundamental in the Buddhist world, because there's one thing that all Buddhists would agree. There's really only one thing. You can get every conceivable kind of path and teaching and so on. I was just, last June, I was in America at a conference of 230 Buddhist teachers from around the world, heads of monasteries in Thailand, in Vietnam, in Tibet, American teachers, young teachers, old teachers, the grandfathers of Dharma in the West, and you know, really the sort of major Dharma teachers. And what was so amazing was the way we were kind of all somehow together, and somehow the basic teaching was shared by everybody, even wearing different robes and coming from different cultures, Buddhist cultures. And so the one message that all Buddhists will agree on is that the Buddha taught, don't cling. Lo litsamed. Don't cling. Reduce fixation, stuckness. And especially stuckness or fixation on the way things ought to be. Because I think things ought to be like this, not like that. That's the fundamental stuckness. The way I think things should be. Usually the way I want them to be, or I need them to be, or they make me more comfortable. And that's the stuckness. And the Buddha said, let them go. The way we are not in control of life. Life is in control of us. So we can't run life and control life according to what makes me comfortable. And in that place, without it allows us to relax from having fixed positions, emdot, having needs and desires that we place in the world, that we want the world to supply, ha'olam l'sapek, to provide us. And we become, in a way, more spontaneous, more free, more, it becomes more of a dance. Our actions in the world become more of a dance, and less stress, and less strain. The biggest burden of clinging is me, is what I am, my labels, my ego, my self. And a Shambhala warrior doesn't care what people think of him or her. It's not interesting, not because there's a message saying I mustn't think about what people think of me. I mustn't care what people think of me. It's just not interesting to go down that road. So that means a huge amount of freedom to go into difficult places and to be yourself, never mind where, and never mind what people think of you. And the professors who are ready to sit in the tent in Wall Street or Rehov Rothschild, the people who are in society but actually are totally free and don't care what people think of them and are ready to step out and do what's in their heart. It's a power, and it makes us both bold and also gentle. Because if we have less busy, we're less busy with ourselves, we can be more powerful, but also humble. Because less busy with ourselves, we don't need to be somebody, we don't need to bang, it's me that did it, I did it. Like a story yesterday, the Bodhisattva, if he made everybody in the world enlightened, and you ask him who did it, he would say, no idea, it happened. So it's a freeing. So we can do wonderful things in the life, but if we don't have pressure to say, me, I did it, it's my project, I want to hold on to it. I have experienced many times of going to retreats and sitting in the back of the room and going to a retreat of Tovana. And I forget completely, I started Tovana. So I could say, my Tovana, I started this wonderful, look at these retreats are happening and so many and so many thousands of people going on retreat. But it kind of completely, I can go into the back of the hall and sit down and meditate and have a teacher teach, and it has no interest who started Tovana. And that's my practice, not to, and I've started many, many organizations in my life, many. Starting from the 1980s, I started alternative medicine organizations in England that are now very big, and I started environmental organizations in the Galil. On and on and on. I've done many and peace organizations in Israel and Middle Way, etc., etc., etc. If I would sort of sit there and be, you know, like, oh, who wants that? What a pain! What a pain! So it leaves you free. It leaves you joyful to start things, to open things, to initiate things, to develop things, and be humble and free because you're not busy with yourself. And it just makes things so much more joyful. Makes action in the world joyful. Change the world with joy, not with pain. Because of this spontaneous, free action that just comes out. That's the Shambhala warrior. It just emerges in a natural way, freely. In my own life, I think one of the big teachings I had was not sitting, not only sitting, but when I came to Israel, I was interested to establish a spiritual community, and for various reasons, well, we did manage to find some land, and we did gather some people together, and this was in 1981, and the Sochnut gave us a piece of land to start a spiritual community in the Galil. And then I was in England, and I saw in the newspaper that the local Arabs were making a demonstration on the road that had just been made up to this hill, and I realized that the whole thing couldn't happen because you can't establish a spiritual community on land that's basically taken. So that finished that, and I went to Clil and helped to establish Clil as a not a spiritual community, but nevertheless an ideological community, certainly based on the principles of ecology, Mahatma Gandhi. It had ideology, although it wasn't a spiritual community. And the most powerful thing, I think, was that spending years picking stones from the earth. That's what happened from 1981 to 1983, 84. I just, every day, I went down. I'm an academic. I have a doctorate in biochemistry from England. This professor kind of picking stones from the earth, picking stones day after day after day. It was beautiful. It was a cleaning process. I felt all my previous life was irrelevant, didn't exist, there was nobody here, it was just stones to be picked. And after that, buildings with the stones. And somehow or other, it feels like, okay, going back to being a falach, a peasant, but what a process of cleaning and of starting fresh and of not getting stuck to what I ought to be and what I've been trained, I should be a this, I should be a that, I should be this. Just letting it all go day after day after day after day is very powerful for me and very freeing. I don't mean to say you all have to do it, but it's great. It's just wonderful to be a nobody. It's wonderful. It's just beautiful to be a nobody. Because you're nobody, also everybody. You're just in the earth. You're just part of the world. You don't have to be so busy being a person with a kind of a mission and an importance. And in some way or other, there is the one other character of the Shambhala warrior that you can't really label him or her. There's something there that is very unclear, because the label doesn't fit. And I remember, you know, you've probably all read Castaneda, how he would meet Don Juan, and you see this guy in a park bench in a small town in Mexico, or you'd see him dressed up in a suit, perfect, like Krishnamurti, perfect suit, three-piece suit, like a kind of businessman. And you don't know who he is. And he's a wild, crazy shaman. But he can come in a suit and you don't know. Yeah. And one of the other places that we have to let go of to be a Shambhala warrior is the place of emotions. And these are, because they're so strong and so powerful, they tend to take us over. And the nice thing about what we did yesterday in the Truth Mandala was that the act of giving the emotions, allowing them space, was also the act of letting them disappear. And so, with emotional life, we do need to acknowledge the emotions, just like we do in meditation, to actually see the material coming up and be fully there with it, not push it down, not put it on the bama, not make a big story out of it, not work on it and have to deal with it, but allow it to be what it is and then let it go. And the Shambhala warrior is someone that is not under the control of emotions, but will experience emotions, but they're not controlling emotions. I once watched the Dalai Lama on film, and he was someone was challenging him about the situation of women in the Tibetan community, and he simply cried. That was his response. He cried and then he laughed, and then he said, I can't do everything, I do what I can, but this whole thing is so tradition, the tradition is so big that I cannot change, radically change things, but I'm doing the best I can. So it's just the response of his tears was really a beautiful response of a free being allowing the emotions to come. And I'm sure the Buddha felt emotions. He wasn't neutral like a machine. We all feel emotions because they're part of life, but let them go, because they're not very reliable as powers that we attack when we're attached to them. They're not very reliable as powers to act in the world. We need to be a little freer. But there's one emotion that I think the Shambhala warrior does have, and that's Chogyam Trungpa talked about it, And that's the emotion of sadness. And it can be when all the other emotions are kind of, in a way, you're not angry anymore. Even though you see all the suffering around, the anger comes and it goes, but you're not ruled by anger. But there can be a sadness, which is a bit like the Greek pathos, I don't know exactly, but it's sadness of samsara, actually, of the pain of the world. It's like compassion. It's close to compassion. It's just seeing the pain of the world and feeling, yes, there is pain in the world, and sharing that pain can have a certain enduring sadness. But it's not a, it's one of the big emotions. Sadness, in a way, is one of the emotions that are big and make you big as a response. So what kind of what does social action look like from this point of view? What kind of actions, what does it feel like to take part in a social action based on the Dharma? I think that one of the actions we did, the peace walks, were really an attempt to develop a kind of action that embodies the Dharma and changes the world. And it's interesting that one of the things that we talk about in the peace walks is not to wave flags, not to support strong views. When we did one peace walk, it was a big one, from the village of Bharta to the wall, the separation wall, and there was like, I think there was 300 people on this walk, about 200, 250 Palestinians and 50, 60, 70 Israelis and foreign people from abroad. And the Palestinians brought all their flags. And the young people brought their flags, started to wave the Palestinian flag. I went to the leaders and said, this is no flag territory here. We're not walking behind flags. We're walking for something more subtle. Peace doesn't need flags. And anyway, Israelis don't want to walk behind a Palestinian flag, and Palestinians don't want to walk behind an Israeli flag. So the whole thing won't work with flags. Let's leave it. And the youth, the young people, didn't understand at first. And then I explained, or the elders explained, that flags only divide people, and here we're doing something different. And so the atmosphere changed completely. The young people understood. They walked quietly, and we went to the wall, and we sat outside the separation wall, and we sang. We just sang songs together, Palestinians, Israelis, foreign people from abroad, we sang. And we actually danced. And that was the event, for what it was. But I think there's also an unclarity, a beautiful unclarity around the protest in the Mahal, you know. There's something that I read that was very impressive to me about not fixing things with views, allowing things to be more potential, and allowing forces that are more subtle, like love and the desire for change and peace, to manifest, to grow, and not close them down so too quickly with views, with positions, with flags, and so on. Solutions, yeah. So social action would look like that. There's one aspect. Would be without too much personality, personalities, importance, self-importance, and views. Another way that social action would model rather than preach, would not tell people what to do, but would model. Model it. Be the peace that you want in the world. Being it. It's walking your talk. And we discussed this before, and people have said already in the questions and so on, it's so very obvious that you need to be who you want, what you want to see. And if you don't, there's a fundamental, right from the beginning, a fundamental conflict with things that you want because you want them, but you can't get them because you're not living them. So that, and it felt by organizations and by groups and by, I remember one walk we did in the night in Jerusalem, and we were silent walkers walking in past the Terra Sancta there, and there was a Peace Now protest going on, and we walked past them, and so they were standing there with speeches and posters and very loud, and we were walking so quietly next to them, and it was just a nice contrast to feel the two kinds of energies there. And they all stopped and looked at us, because we were all for the same thing, but the way was different and the energy was different. And I don't say that is wrong, because that's another view. They should do what's in their heart to do, but the Shambhala warrior way is different. I'm not judging anybody that wants to go and help and change the world, because they're doing it in the way they can do it. So I don't think we should judge, but with wisdom we can see where we want to go, which way is right for us. And this way it has this character, has a character of being who we want to, the change we want to see. And that needs fearlessness. We need to be less afraid to do that, because it's not being very safe. Safety is sort of being who you usually are, and being comfortable with who you are, and then waving a flag for something you want over there. But it needs a little bit of courage to model the change that you want. And so the other aspect is that we are spreading qualities, not outcomes. That the being the Shambhala warrior, or the way of social action through the Dharma, is, and it's a very important point here, is sowing seeds of qualities, echuyot, how we live, rather than sowing or requesting totsot, outcomes. And so there's not much measuring that goes on. So many times you hear in organizations and so on that we need to measure outcomes, totsot. It's only worth doing this if I can measure that the result will be X parameters of social change. There's no problem in looking and seeing what happens because of the actions that you do. There's a certain wisdom in seeing cause and effect. No problem in seeing cause and effect. I did this, and this is the result. There's a wisdom in that. But if the measuring is the control over what you're doing, you've lost the way. You're in the result, and therefore you're serving only results. And your measuring makes stress and makes difficulty, and in a way makes the loses the Dharma. There's an example of this in the the dialogue that we did in Nablus, that after some time, some years, where we were really left alone to do it in the way, you know, to keep going every month, things got more difficult, and the Palestinian Authority wanted to know what we were doing, why we were bringing Israelis to Nablus, what we were doing there, etc., etc. And we had a meeting with senior people in the Palestinian Authority, and we explained to them what we were doing, and they said, well, all this talking, has it got rid of one settlement from our back that is oppressing us? Did it get rid of any settlement? We said no. So how is it helping us? What does it do for us? All your talking. And we said, we're in a different place there. What we're trying to do is create peace leaders. We're not politicians. We're educators. We're trying to create a different atmosphere. We're helping a teacher talk to his students in a Palestinian school. We actually had quite a lot of teachers coming to our meetings. And one time I remember a Palestinian young man came to me and said, you know the real benefit of what you're doing, of these meetings? The real benefit is that it restored my trust in human beings. My whole attitude to a human being has been destroyed by just seeing soldiers in the street and the oppression that we feel. But you have showed me, just by the few of you that exist and what you're doing, you have showed me that human beings can be something else, and this will stay with me forever. So that cannot be measured. But that person becomes a peace leader. That person, that young Palestinian, will never go back. He can't go back to thinking all human beings are a lost case. And so we plant seeds in the Dharma. Social action is in from the Dharma. It's much more like planting seeds, giving them water and fruit and food, allowing the seeds to grow, and stepping back from measuring or judging outcomes. We'd be delighted if there is an outcome that works, but we're not attached to the outcome. That is, the outcome. If the outcome doesn't work, we have a bigger view. I know that some organizations can't work like that, but that's the way the view or the Shambhala warrior. And I think it's an understanding, it's a big view actually, it's an understanding of karma. It's an understanding that it's not in our hands, that all we can really do is sow these seeds. We can make an illusion that we're making a difference because we write a nice report and show, because of this thing we did, there is a change like that. But in the big picture, after that, next year a war breaks out and everything is gone. Or I mean, the big picture is so changeable, we're not in charge of it. So I don't think we can be disappointed. We need to avoid disappointment by too much measuring. I remember some time ago here on a retreat, the kibbutz, Ein Dor, invited me to meet some of the vatikim of the kibbutz and give an evening and explain to them what we're doing here, and so sort of. And one elderly lady, and they were mostly old people, said, and she was crying, and she said, I had so much belief. We started this kibbutz, Shomer HaTzair, we started it with so much hope and so much, and now look what's happened. It's all, the kibbutz is just becoming no spirit, no ideology left. Everyone is private. It's just private houses. It's no, the kibbutz is disappearing. Does it mean that everything we did was useless? And I said, no, just from this point of view. No, you planted beautiful seeds. You came with so much hope. You came with so much energy. You came with so much vision. And you planted those seeds and you planted the vision. And that's never lost. But you can't expect it to last, the same thing to last forever. There will be change. There will be movements. This will go and something else will come. You can't expect it to last forever. But the seeds that you planted are there. They can't be lost. So a big view of karma helps us here to be less attached to measuring and more sense that we throw seeds into the world and the world will have to, after that, look after them. We can't do more than we can do. So I want to kind of come to a close. To really finish with, I suppose, the hopeful message. If we step out from the small picture, and the small picture is always me, what I need, my pain, my story. When that small picture dissolves through the bigger vision, other things take its place. So it's not that we're trying to kind of reduce ourselves by, some people say, well, I need my ambition. Let me give an example. I need my ambition. My ambition is important. Hashifot are important. Yes, they're good energy. But if we let the attachments, the clinging, be quieter, and the self be less dominant and needy and in charge, there is more space. And this space is almost always a space of love. So love grows when the contraction or the attachments are reduced. It just happens like that. For example, in your own meditation, you can feel, if you're less busy with issues, you can feel some sympathy to yourself. You can feel, I'm here. That's sympathy. That's basically love. I'm with myself. Basically love. And that happens when the small picture is reduced. The pain and the anger and so on are reduced, then the love grows. And the love is the main basis for acting in the world. Underneath it all, it's our love. And the love is because we are belonging. Love and belonging are the same thing. So we want to help the person across the road who's blind because we are them. We help the beggar in India when we leave our hotel because the beggar is us. We feel for him or her. And this sense of love is a big power. And it's behind everything. It sort of stands behind everything. And we might lose it, we might forget it, we might not see it, but it's called the immeasurable. These qualities of love and compassion and sympathy are immeasurable. You can't measure them. They don't fit any box. They're a huge source of power and energy for us in the world. I think I'll leave it at that. In the end, acting with the eye of Dharma is acting from love. I think I'll leave it at that. Thank you. So I'd like to just have 1 minute of silence, and then Shiri is going to share also.